Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Right, you are very welcome along to the Sunday Papers here on Off the Ball. It's a no-holds-barred online exclusive for you this afternoon. So if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook or Periscope, you're very welcome. We've got Paul O'Hare of the Irish Daily Mirror and Emmett Ryan of the Sunday Business Post, also editor of ballineurope.com, with me in studio. Gentlemen, you're very welcome.
Cheers.
Great to be here.
We will go through the back pages, first of all, before getting stuck into any of the stories. We're going to start this morning with the Star, which goes with Vars, how raging, lamps fuming. Couple of instances yesterday in the Premier League, the most notable of which the inset photograph there of Cesar Azpilicueta and Giovanni Lo Celso in a decision that wasn't overturned, but Stockley Park came up and said we were wrong to not send Lo Celso off after that. You've also got bell toll for Ole. This is Liverpool, who've now entered the race, according to the Star, for Birmingham City teenage wonder Jude Bellingham, leaving Manchester United facing more transfer misery. The Irish Daily Mail leads with the rugby. New era ready for liftoff. Farrell's men can take giant step forward with triple crown glory in Twickenham. Devon Toner there being lifted by two of his teammates, of course, starting the game today. The Sunday Times is going with the VAR story as well. That is a leg breaker. It's a quote from Lampard. Furious after VAR fails to punish Lo Celso's stamp on Azpilicueta as Chelsea beat Spurs 2-1. The Sunday World, meanwhile, goes with father and son, Andy Farrell, willing to take a wrecking ball to his own son's ambitions to seize an Irish victory in today's game of Twickenham family fortunes. The Sunday Mirror then goes with VAR new low. Spurs star stamps on Azpilicueta, bungling video ref doesn't send him off, and then his bosses later admit, we made a mistake. We promise we won't get too much into VAR today, although Emmett's got a special roundup at the end of the paper review this morning to go into it. The Sun, meanwhile, goes with a bridge to VAR. Lo Celso leg-breaker U-turn farce. Video ref coot boobs in second game. And back in the twick of it, Devon's tall story. And you've also got the scoreline there from Croke Park last night. Far from flawless. Dublin 115, Donegal 114. And then finally, the Sunday Independent, which leads with Joe Brawley's kind of half report, half a selection of musings from Croke Park last night. Dubs get their just desserts. And that is where we are going to start today. Joe Brawley's column from Croke Park last night. Paul, you were commenting before we came on air about how it's a fairly impressive piece of writing given how late in the day it came yesterday.
Yeah, I think with sort of match reporting, you can have just two sides of the coin as such in the one game. There's the daytime games, the 3 o'clock games where, or you know, 3 o'clock throw, independent of which sport you're covering. I cover soccer, so say even a daytime game, you have a fair bit of time to appreciate the match, to actually watch the match, to go out and source your quotes afterwards, and then maybe write a bit more of a considered piece. But more often than not, the games that I'd be covering, be it the Irish international team, the League of Ireland on a weekly beat, they're more often than not nighttime games. You know, so you're kind of conditioned to just churning it out as the game's going along. You're writing as the game goes on. You don't have that time to sort of sit back and write a very sort of considered piece. So I was just kind of taken by some of the lines in Joe's piece from last night. Now, it was a 7 o'clock throw-in at Croke Park, so there is that little bit more time than, say, an 8 o'clock kickoff in a soccer match.
That improves enough, though, like, you know?
It's tight enough. The game, it's a shorter game, obviously, than a soccer match. But
that improved himself at the League of Ireland, is what you're saying, before commenting on him as a great writer.
But no, there's just some interesting takeaways, or some interesting points he makes in terms of just turning a piece around so quickly for the next game, or for the next day's paper. Now, there is a specific match report inside by another writer, but you know, Joe is sort of, rather than a sweeping sort of analysis of the whole game last night, he sort of hones in on one or two of the more central aspects, namely the performance of the two goalkeepers, Sean Paton and Lesso. He doesn't really give too much of a mention to Evan Comerford, but he sort of opens by saying Sean Paton, the Donegal goalkeeper, gave a cordon bleu demonstration of goalkeeping for the connoisseur in the first half in Croke Park. The only problem was he made a mess of the dessert. And he's referring, obviously, to the Dublin goal, the Paul Mannion goal that got them back into the game very late on. Keeper made a bit of a hash of it. He used to play League of Ireland football, as it happens, Sean Paton. He would have been with Finn Harps, Sligo Rovers, Derry City. Not necessarily as their number one, but obviously got the break in with the Donegal team. So he's sort of talking about how the spotlight is on the goalkeeper this morning because of the mistake. The Dubs take advantage and sort of kick on and win the game. And he says, it's the next bit that's important for Patton, Brolly writes. Stephen Cluckson had many bad moments in his early years. I remember in particular an All-Ireland quarter-final against Armagh when he was sent off for a selfish and ridiculous act and the Dubs collapsed. I said afterwards, if I was the Dublin manager, he wouldn't wear the jersey again. He gathered himself and went on to redefine goalkeeping.
And the only mistake Joe made there was a qualifier, not a quarter-final, but still very impressive.
Yeah. But he says, he goes on to say, Patton must accept the lesson and forget about the error. He's a kid in goalkeeping terms after all. We'll see now what he's made of. And after that, the piece sort of goes into a little bit more of in terms of match analysis. But he sort of says, you know, in terms of Dublin being pushed close by Donegal, Dublin's comeback against Monaghan, he says the reality here, this is the closing line in the piece, he says the reality is that Dublin were always going to win this game, and at no point did it feel that they wouldn't. They thrive in adversity because, like all champions, they have to grow to love the championship moments. Like a great boxer who claps his gloves in glee and excitement when he realises his opponent is very good indeed, so Dublin are in their element when it is really put up to them. And then the closing line, their comeback against Monaghan a fortnight ago was the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen on a Gaelic football field. It reminds us all that they would win a sixth All-Ireland in a row this year, even if they were managed by Jim Gavin's baseball cap. It's a great line, you know, it's a nice line to have that sort of...
It's really going to turn around, though, in that sort of time frame, gamers, because like, if you're doing a gamer, often it's just make sure you get nothing wrong. Not like, you know, well, can I be kind of colourful as like sort of bonus territory, or even if I know it's a column base, but it's more hit your key points. Like, the time for lyricism is a bit more challenging when you got those sort of tight deadlines on you.
Yeah. Like the line about Jim Gavin's baseball cap, I just wonder if actually what has happened here is that there is a very similar human being underneath the baseball cap that is now existing this year, and perhaps he will continue to exist in a very similar sphere where he doesn't get enough credit because we actually just don't know how much he's doing, which is probably quite a lot, Desi Farrell, and it seems to have been a seamless enough transition. The most extraordinary thing ever seen on a Gaelic football field, to come back against Monaghan in the National League in front of your home fans, perhaps a bit of a stretch.
Slightly, like, you know, I was thinking, like, you know, I was like, I'm pretty certain, like, you know, Joe has commentated on several games that were far more extraordinary as well in that respect. Mm.
The Cluckson point then in the middle is about, I presume the point he's trying to get at here is that Sean Patton and his response is what's important here, not the fact that he actually makes an error.
Yeah, because like I was at that game in 2003 when Cluckson totally lost the head, and it was moment of madness, jumping on Stephen McDonald with a kick, and he, you know, I was saying to you before we went on air, it's like it's hard for a goalie to look like he's going for a red card all game, but Cluckson managed it in that game. He looked like he was asking to be sent off for most of that match, which for a goalkeeper is particularly challenging. So, like, yeah, at that stage, you know, like Brolly was obviously saying it more as a guy just covering it, but for most Dublin fans, it's like we don't need that head case. Which now the last phrase I think anyone would use to describe the way Stephen Cluckson plays today is as a head case. He is the most focused, driven in guy going. And he's so, you know, regimented now. So a lot of that comes with maturity, but also came at like looking within himself as what he needed to change about himself as a footballer.
Can we look at this a different way entirely and look at Dublin's three matches in Croke Park so far this year?
Yeah.
Obviously, Kerry, Donegal, Monaghan, all putting them to the pin of their collar. Is there any hope from that, that perhaps a baseball cap alone may actually not be able to drive Dublin to six in a row?
It can be perceived as you know, they are going through change with Desi Farrell in, and that, you know, the closeness of some of these games offers outside other teams, it offers them a chance. But at what sort of full, you know, they're not playing at full pelt at the moment. You know, they're bringing in new players, they're blooding new players, they're doing pretty much what the league is supposed to be for.
And I guess every opponent is earmarking Croke Park as their most important game.
Like, you can see the way Monaghan played against them. Like, Monaghan, this is like, you know, this is our big one to win. It's like, well, not really, it's February, you know, it's like, and that's kind of the problem.
Yeah, and there was a lot of moaning, I think, about the extra time that was played in that Monaghan game, but there was times in that game where Monaghan fairly sort of cynically were looking to slow that game down, and, you know, I don't have a huge degree of sympathy for them.
We're going to turn to the Sunday Times this morning and get our rugby coverage underway, because David Walsh has got an exclusive interview with Jonathan Sexton. The headline is, "The ideal day for Andy would be Owen having a great game, but Ireland winning." Johnny Sexton idolising Farrell Sr. as a child, and now Ireland's captain is plotting to limit the influence of Farrell Jr. today. So David Walsh has gone to Johnny Sexton's house and actually sat down with him and had a chat about a few various elements of his career. And one of the things that sticks out to me quite a bit at the start is about this moment in Twickenham 10 years ago, so his first Six Nations start for Johnny Sexton. His memory of that first day Back in the change room, I thought, we've won at Twickenham, that's okay. Then Paul O'Connell came in and he was like, I can't believe we won here. He was just over the moon, ecstatic. I was a little bit disappointed because I'd kicked my first 10 kicks in international rugby and thought I couldn't miss. I missed a few that day and I was down about that. Paul is right though. I lost my next three Six Nations games at Twickenham, which is interesting because I think we all got into this sense of normalcy that going to Twickenham, or at the very least going up against England, was actually not this terrifying prospect when we won numerous
there was like
triple
three
crowns.
And 4 years, wasn't there, wins over England? So it became, well, we're probably going to win this game, was the mentality going into it like. And I mean, as a viewer, never mind as a player, like, you know, it's obviously the players are going to believe they're going to win, but yeah, like mentality wise, even the casual viewer was like, that's only England. Like, it wasn't quite there, but it wasn't what it would have been growing up or England, you know.
Johnny Sexton trudging off the pitch, not entirely happy with a win over England, is possibly the most Johnny Sexton anecdote there is.
Yeah, it totally is. It's like, and like, you know, it's like, it's a lot of these guys who are sort of, you know, your leaders on the pitch, who aren't necessarily noted for being the most vocal guy necessarily, but it's all about the work rate, like sort of leading by example. And that's Sexton, like, just to a T in terms of how he's always played the game, because he's not the most, you know, personable chap in terms of like what he's like on the pitch. You look at him, he's kind of going, Jesus, you know, does he even enjoy a cup of tea at times, like, you know? But like, you can see also that, like, he is just so driven, so focused, and just trying to get everything out of everybody else around him. Like,
I do think, I think it's kind of interesting as well, just in terms of this being an exclusive interview that the Sunday Times got. Like, there's plenty of words in it, but I don't know whether it's a reflection on just Sexton at the moment. He's sort of in that position now as captain that he's coveted for years, and that just by the natural tendency of you know, of being a captain, that there isn't, you don't give away too much, you're still kind of closely guarded, because, you know, there's references in David Walsh's pieces here to calling up to Sexton's house for the interview, and he gets a text message from Sexton saying, would you do us a favour and ring my phone when you get to the door, don't ring the doorbell so the kids wake up, you know. So like, he's obviously had good access to Sexton. And they're probably, like, there's no big reveal in the piece, you know, when you'd maybe be looking for something a little bit deeper about the person, about the man. We all know he's fiercely driven and that type of stuff. I just thought that you might have got a little bit more, maybe just sort of about the person out of the piece.
I think it illuminates elements of Johnny Sexton's character a bit more than perhaps we would have thought. Like, he goes back to this New Zealand game in 2013, obviously the one that Ireland conceded a late try and end up losing. He says that Joe Schmidt, the head coach, didn't see the penalty. Sorry, this is David Walsh, obviously. Didn't see the penalty as the problem, but the team's inability to survive the final 4 minutes, because, of course, Sexton himself misses a late penalty to put Ireland 8 clear in that game. So Sexton then says about that, in the aftermath of Schmidt's response to him missing that penalty, it became Joe's new thing. Everything we will do will be 4 minutes. So 4 minutes was obviously the time they had to hang on, and Ryan Crotty scored that try. 4 minutes ball in hand, no let up. 4 minutes defending, 4 minutes attack, no break, no time to draw breath. We always wondered if we'd ever have one sequence in a match that long. It happened once, Paris in 2018. The sustained attack at the end went on for over 5 minutes. It got us a drop goal, led to the Grand Slam, which is actually kind of remarkable that Joe Schmidt had clearly this big obsession with the All Blacks for a huge period of his time at Ireland. 2013, coming so close, he obviously had a singular focus on beating the All Blacks soon thereafter. He succeeded in doing that, but his methods, the 4 minute trials that they'll have in training, actually helped him win a Grand Slam in 2018. So like, we've kind of dissected 2019 so much, but I think what is blatantly clear at this point is that Schmidt's ideological view on rugby had just been hardened so much come the end of 2018, because he had put this into practice after the disappointment of the All Blacks, and it had worked. This sort of training had actually worked on this Irish team. So I think it illuminates a little bit more about what Schmidt was actually doing in and around that time.
Just on a different point in this Sexton interview, like, so, you know, there's been a lot of chat about the Farrells, you know, the Andy and Owen Farrell, but Sexton's talking about the 2013 Lions tour where he was a roommate with Owen Farrell, you know, and that's not new, but they're talking here, there's just an interesting quote about the two, Sexton in terms of just being so focused and so driven. He says, in the David Walsh interview, he says, we roomed together a lot, maybe 6 weeks sharing the same room on that tour. People might make their minds up about Owen by how they see him on the pitch, but he's actually a down-to-earth good guy. I enjoyed his company. We talked a lot. We could have talked about anything, but we ended up talking mostly about rugby.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So, like, if you're rooming with a guy for 6 weeks, and you pretty much admit that all you talked about was work, you know, like, yeah, it gives you a bit of an insight into the mindset.
You would have thought that they would have found something else. Like, is there not an inkling there, when even if you're on the same team for those intense few weeks, that you're like, this guy's still going to be going up against me in the Six Nations next year. Let's talk about something that's not rugby, that's our profession that we're actually in conflict with most of the time.
And it's like, in fairness, like Owen Farrell during the week said, like in one of the interviews, like, does he still talk to his dad about rugby? He goes, well, yeah, like, you know, because again, it's a case of we have to talk about something, and it's one of the things we have in common, even though they are going up against each other. Because it's not, remember, Andy's obviously been involved in the Irish setup for quite a while, so, you know, he's been playing against his son in some capacity for quite a while, like coaching against his son. And it's like, yeah, still, it's like, maybe with some people, it's just easiest to talk about the job, you know? And I'm fairly certain of it with Sexton, that the job is the nicest thing for him to talk about, even because he's the type of guy who's clearly, he's never forgotten a single kick he took in training, like, you know? And so it's like, for him, 6 weeks with Owen Farrell, who clearly seems with the same mindset, let's just talk work, it's great. Mm. Probably the most relaxing thing he could do.
There's a there's another interesting line in it, just in terms of the Owen Farrell dimension. And it's sort of a question from David Walsh to Sexton. He says, it can't be easy for the Irish players discussing how they're going to lessen the influence of England's captain. And Sexton says, that can be difficult. You know that the relationship is there. It's not like we're targeting him. If anything, it's about being ready for him. Now, that's kind of the answer that you give the journalist in the interview. I'm sure behind closed doors it's slightly similar, because, as we'll come on to in a few minutes, the English approach to targeting Sexton
very different.
Is very, very,
very different.
Well,
yeah.
The one thing he says in there is, we're lucky. If Owen was crap, it might be a bit awkward, which of course it would be. You're like, yeah, Andy, your son is really good at rugby and we're definitely going to give him all the respect he deserves. Whereas in actual fact now, it's a little bit different. Just one of the other things that came out from this 2013 Lions tour, Sexton says that there was a moment when Andy was complimenting him publicly in a team meeting. I'm competing with his son for out half, and he's done that for both of them. It's what's best for the team, that he's got his dad standing out there talking about his closest rival in the team and how amazing he is and the dynamic that comes with that. Like, there's, he goes on to talk about a little bit more about the great team of the first decade of the century. Like Paul O'Connell, he goes back to saying that Brian O'Driscoll, and how unusual it was that the most talented player on your team is also the most competitive. He said the same about Owen Farrell in this, that the talisman who is the most competitive player in the team. And then Walsh has this line, Sexton mentions this, not realising he could be describing himself. I think it's probably more true for Brian O'Driscoll, maybe given the flair that he showed being the most talented and possibly the most competitive, as we've learned later on in his career. But it is an interesting point. It is rare that you do have your most talented star being the most competitive as well. There's not many people you could turn to in sport that actually have that. Like, obviously, Roy Keane is perhaps somebody that we would look to. Like, LeBron James is another person.
Yeah,
I think if you keep the American theme going, Tom Brady's probably the opposite of that, as in he was the unbelievable workhorse to become the very best.
Yeah. It's a curious one, because like you mentioned, like Roy obviously, but even though with Roy though, in United he was really the best player on the team. So I suppose he had that sort of weird duality where with Ireland there was no question this is the best footballer playing for Ireland. With United there was always one or two other guys who were kind of going, well, they're same level of talent. So he had to work that bit harder to show he meant more to that team. And so I suppose there was an unusual thing, whereas with LeBron it was basically, I suppose he's the one who stands out more in a Sexton position, because he's always been the best player wherever he's gone, whatever he's done. Sexton has largely been that as well, like, you know, coming through the ranks. And you've also, when you are that naturally the best, being able to keep the drive, it isn't easy, because, you know, it's part of this, why can't people catch up with me? Why can't they be as good as me, like, on my own team? Like,
Sexton in the piece, he's talking about sort of being a captain at Leinster and being a captain at Ireland, and sort of how he deals with it. And he's sort of saying that Leo Cullen reminds me that if I'm giving them, i.e. other players, a hard time, it can be tough for them because they look up to me. It's better to have a conversation than to shout at people. I am trying, but at times I slip back into the old ways. I'm a work in progress.
Absolutely. There's a good few mentions of Sexton as well in Shane Horgan's piece and Stuart Barnes' piece, and we'll get to Mike Brown's piece in the Sunday Mail as well, which is very, very interesting. Just on what Shane Horgan is saying about him, he says that he's not surprised that Sexton is captain, but Horgan says, I was forced to think again about his dual duties of leadership and goal kicking recently when chatting to Ronan O'Gara. I'd always assumed that Ronan was ready to take on a kick at goal whenever his captain asked, yet he confided that there had been times when he wasn't sure about this, but the decision wasn't his. He was instructed by the captain to take the kick. So when you're the captain as well as the kicker, it brings a new weight of responsibility. But you'd imagine Johnny Sexton is fairly well capable of handling that responsibility.
It's like, although mentioning the Barnes piece in the same sort of section there, it's like, not so much about Johnny Sexton, but about Jonathan Joseph, possibly the kindest way of saying a guy is good against bad teams I've ever seen written. It's like, it's actually too long to even go into direct quoting, but he basically finds a way of saying, Jonathan Joseph, nice guy, really good against terrible rugby teams. And it's like one of the cruelest kind ways of phrasing things ever said. Like, now, in fairness, he makes a good point about it. He's concerned about Joseph under Conway's kicks today. I think that's the key point he's trying to get across, is that Jones has been a bit conservative, is what Barnes is trying to say in the piece, by going with Jonathan Joseph, because he's got the number of caps and he has played a little on the wing for England before. But that maybe had he looked at one of his other less experienced options, it would have been probably more productive for England against Ireland today than with Jonathan Joseph. You know what you're going to get, is essentially his argument. Like,
so. Yeah, that is his argument. He also makes this argument. He says, under Farrell, there have been a definite loosening of the Joe Schmidt era. A far greater coach than most of his charges were players. A fact they should remember as they try to sell their books, says Stuart Barnes this morning. In the Sunday
pretty
Times.
Saucy this morning, Stuart. Like, you know, it's like across the board with that.
If you're not going to be saucy for England versus Ireland, as Stuart Barnes, and when are you ever going to be saucy?
Fair.
Speaking of which, Mike Brown in the Mail on Sunday. Paul, you've got it open there in front of you. What's he saying?
I really enjoyed this. If you don't mind me just reading out maybe four or five paragraphs right at the very... This is how he opens the piece. So Mike Brown, the English international, he says, you always know when it's an Ireland test week because the coaches put a life-size cardboard cutout of Johnny Sexton in the team dining room. It's there 24-7, breakfast, lunch and dinner, to remind the players that they need to shut out Ireland's main man. Throughout every analysis or training session, Sexton's name will constantly come up because he's their emotional and tactical leader. Everything Ireland do well goes through him, so there would always be a huge amount of focus, blah, blah, blah. Now that he's taken over the captaincy from Rory Best, he's even more influential, so England's emphasis will only multiply. In training, the opposition number 10 will be wearing a green bib and will constantly hear defenders shouting, smash Sexton, I've got Sexton. It's a bit of a short straw because whoever wears that bib will be on the receiving end of a few rib shots. You want them to hurt. You know, so when Sexton in the David Walsh piece is kind of been slightly diplomatic about how Ireland are going to approach the Owen Farrell situation, the English side of it with Mike Brown today in the Mail is you know, spells it out pretty clear from the top of the piece.
I wonder, did they get the cardboard cutout from Spar? Because if you go into any Spar around Ireland at the moment, you will see a life-size cutout of Johnny Sexton. Yeah. I wonder, did the English coaching staff just go in there and actually transport
it's
it
Macy
over?
It's Macy mean, though, isn't it? Sorry, it's Macy, not Spar.
Oh, sorry. Oh, my apologies. I can't believe I've got my small to medium grocery stores mixed up.
The other line in the Brown piece, sort of, you know, that's how they target Sexton. And he says the outcome of the rough treatment is that Sexton starts rushing his decisions and rushing his skills. It leaves him with no time in his hands and he feels suffocated, so he starts sitting deeper and deeper. That's a win for the defence because it makes it harder to get over the gain line. If he can run away and if he can't run away and he can't pass, then he has to kick it away. So this is sort of teeing it up for the physical sort of encounter that everyone expects that it's going to be over there.
For sure. He mentions as well that he might start throwing his toys out of the pram, to use Mike Brown's words, if he's grounded a bit, and he'll start remonstrating with the referee. The thing that makes you feel warm and fuzzy inside, though, is hearing this line from an Englishman. They've all got a good kick chase in their armoury because of their Gaelic football background, and you position yourself accordingly. Nothing makes you feel sweeter on the day of an English-Irish game than Mike Brown crediting a GAA background for our strength as a rugby team.
Does Sexton play GAA? I don't know.
Absolutely, no, I don't think so. Kerry Roots, though.
Yeah. Well, then, yeah, absolutely. It's in the blood, literally.
Is there anything else from the match today in terms of preview that you want to get to before we move on? Like, it's certainly noticeable, the tone or lack thereof, from Eddie Jones across the papers today, because he's done a hell of a lot of press conferences this week, but there haven't been too many daggers pointed towards Ireland.
That's the thing, because like, he's talked a lot this week, but not what you normally expect Eddie Jones, England-Ireland week, which is, and we see this in the papers, it doesn't play out at all in these either. Normally you're getting peak Eddie Jones troll mode. Like, this is like the one thing you look forward to be honest, with England-Ireland week, is Eddie Jones totally just trying to get those daggers in. And it's like, all the coverage this week, it's very much, like, Jones's name doesn't really come up, to be honest, about it. Anything we're seeing this Sunday, like, you know, I say that we've got like one right beside us here, but like, for the most part, like,
well, this is another piece in the Mail on Sunday. It's from their English edition that's been carried over here. So it's sort of, the sense of it is, you know, where's the quote? Jones, the evil genius, or Jones, the busted flush? Today's result to a large extent will answer that question. And it's just sort of talking about the pressure that he's under, depending on which way this result goes, you know. The opening is, it's a piece by Nick Simon. It says, after landing a sloppy kiss on the face of his dog, Annie, Eddie Jones hopped in a luxury Mercedes from Penny Hill Park to Twickenham. He may as well have walked in on a tightrope. You know, so that sort of sets the scene in terms of how his afternoon could go in terms of the ramifications.
Are they not totally satisfied to allow a flop Six Nations here or there, given what happened last year, beating the All Blacks in the World Cup semi-final, the inverse of Ireland?
If they're smart, they should. Like, yeah, because, like, you know, well, had a flop Six Nations, but that led to a fantastic timing for the World Cup, and got to a World Cup final beating the All Blacks, like you're saying. It's like, whereas us, it's like, you know, we had a grand slam and then the following season was not upbeat, I think is the phrase we best use to describe what happened with Ireland in the following World Cup season. And it's like, yeah, strangely enough, if you give me the option, it's like, chance of beating the All Blacks in World Cup semi, I'll have my up and down, you know, form between Six Nations seasons. And although it is like the way they always be stuff with the English before 2003 was it was great. The English would peak perfectly in Lions years, not in World Cup years. So that's why the Lions were so strong through the 90s. Like, you know, it's like kind of go, well, I suppose, yeah, that's how it worked out.
Yeah. It's funny, not upbeat is probably the most upbeat way I've heard 2019 described in an Irish rugby sense.
Stuart Burns is clearly inspiring me today to be kind, like, you know.
We will move on to the football and Leeds rugby there. There's good stuff from Tommy Conlon and the Sunday Independent as well on Twickenham and all that sort of stuff. And Neil Francis as well talking about the potential of handbags today. So good further reading there if you're interested. But onto the football, as I say, a couple of good pieces in the Mail on Sunday today. And I think we're going to start with Andy Robertson.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I just by my nature in terms of my own job, I always go through the Sunday papers looking for something Irish related, you know, just a bit of an Irish story or whatever. There isn't really one this weekend, you know, in terms of Irish football, Irish soccer. So I was sort of looking elsewhere for sort of the meatier sort of stories as such. And I think Ollie Holt's piece with the Liverpool defender Andy Robertson in the mail, two-page spread. I think it's actually it's a great read. It's sort of Robertson and why he appeals and why the sort of the cop love him so much and the sort of the working class boy doing good, you know. But there's a lot of stuff in it, you know. He's definitely spoke before about when he worked at Marks and Spencer's in Glasgow and that type of thing and how the fans relate to him because of that. You know, he's sort of saying, where are we going? He goes, for people to say to me that it was a fairy tale to leave Marks and Spencer's behind, he goes, people work in these supermarkets, I feel that's a bit disrespectful. These are normal lives and people can have very good life working there. How many of them are in our stands over the weekend? And there I am saying, I've left this terrible life behind and moved on. Of course, I could get, I get paid better. Would I be happier playing football working than an M&S? Yes, of course. But that was my life and this is the person I am today, you know. Money doesn't necessarily bring me happiness. But, you know, there's good sort of background stuff in terms of just growing up in Glasgow. And then it's sort of, the interview is phased in terms of, you know, his early life, getting to Liverpool. And then I think the stuff at the end is really nice in terms of the Champions League semi-final, the miracle of Anfield that night and the incident with Lionel Messi when quite early in the game himself and Fabinho I think did a job on Messi. He was on the ground and he sort of was running after a ball and then he sort of stopped in his tracks, Robertson, and he comes back and Messi's on the ground protesting and he kind of puts his hand on his head and kind of ruffles his hair, and it kind of set the tone for that night and the sort of the wonder of that night. But he's looking back on it, and he says here in the piece, he says, I do look back on that moment with Messi as one I regret. I don't like seeing it. When I saw it afterwards, I was gutted. To do that to the greatest player that has ever played, .. That's not me as a person, that's not my personality, but that night a lot of things happened that you don't really remember. There was no thought process behind it. The fans were roaring and you get caught up in it. You're a human being. You know, so it's just a nice sort of insight into sort of an incident that does still stick out in the mind, you know.
Is he being too hard on himself there?
I think he's being very hard on himself there. Like, you know, it's like it was an emotional thing and it wasn't like he tried to box the head off Lionel Messi. He was trying to sort of get inside his head, a bit of mind games, like, you know.
Yeah.
I think that, like, you know, very, very harsh on himself altogether with that. Like.
Yeah, and he sums it up here again. He says, beforehand, it was the loudest changing room I've ever been in before a game. You could see the focus and determination in all of us, and maybe I went over the line. So, you know, there's an acceptance there that on his behalf that he was, you know, a bit over the top. But I agree with Emmett, like, all's fair in love and war.
Yeah, I think it's, like, you know, Champions League semi-final, if that's the worst thing you're doing, you're all right.
It's not like you walked past and slapped him or punched him, you know. He just ruffled his hair, you know. And it set the tone and let Messi know he was in for a game as well.
Absolutely. He goes through a couple of other instances as well. The laughing in Tom Davis's face in the Merseyside Derby a couple of months ago and kind of saying that it didn't come across the way it was, the way it looked anyway, that he was kind of trying to laugh off a serious incident and trying to brush it off sort of thing rather than actually laughing in his face. And then he gets into this situation in Doha with Rafinha when he goes up and the camera and the audio obviously picks up the the fact that he's going to get Rafinha on behalf of Sadio Mane in the second half, and he says that that's an unfortunate thing. I didn't want to come across as that sort of player. But if it comes to protecting a teammate, I like to think that my teammates protect me as much as I try to protect them. He like mentions Roy Keane here, mentions Vieira, mentions Fernandinho in this breath, that he's going to stick up for his teammate no matter what's going to happen, no matter what audio actually comes through in the microphone. He will go out and combat, go into full combat if the needs require. And I think there are three different instances here. I don't think Robertson needs to stand back and say, I regret this. I think like he does stand over some of these things, and I think that's the perfect stance of being just on the right side of the edge.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's exactly what you're saying. It's like he's not the guy who's going in then with the dodgy tackle or with the, you know, the big whack. He's the guy who's trying to get in the head more than anything else, and he's not being particularly nasty, being frank about it, not trying to underplay himself, because I'm sure he likes to think he's got a bit of a hard edge. What he's doing is pretty tame, you know, and it's like, he knows how far to go without bringing it too far, like, yeah.
Yeah, like this Liverpool side obviously have to have this in them. No team is going to win the Premier League without this edge. Like, he mentions Fernandinho there. Like, one of the big themes of Manchester City down through the last season, even when they were wobbling last season, was Fernandinho is missing. Whenever he's out of the team, or this season when he's pushed to centre-back, they miss his edge in the middle of the park.
Like, if you look at City since he's joined, the performance with and without him is two different teams. Like, you know, it's actually bizarre to look at this actual raw results part. Like, for, you know, and it's like not the most skillful player City have, but certainly most determined, and that makes a difference.
This is the sort of thing that Andy Robertson should be doing to every single Atletico Madrid player at the return leg in Anfield, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
If there's somebody sitting on their arse, ruffling their hair, doing whatever, telling Sadio Mane again, I will get revenge for you after what happened in the first half to you at the Wanda. Like, this right here is a menu of things Andy Robertson perhaps should be doing when they're 1-0 down to a Diego Simeone team.
And just the phrase you used there about a menu of things, what I like about this article from a writer's point of view, Ollie Holt, like he's met him at Melwood in an office, so he's had a one-on-one sit-down with Andy Robertson. And sometimes I think, as a journalist, you can try and just cover too many, you know, try and tick too many boxes and just try and get a bit of everything into it, and it doesn't just work. So Holt's done his homework. He's done his stuff. The initial part of the piece is about Robertson, why the couple of them, everything we touched on earlier on there about working in M&S. And he's broken it up into three different parts, as we said, you know, the incidents that we referred to there, the Merseyside Derby incident and the Messi incident. So he's picked, Ollie Holt has consciously picked, you know, done his homework. He's picked three or four incidents that might necessarily, if you were told you're interviewing Andy Robertson tomorrow, mightn't be the first thing that jumps out that you're thinking of. It's very easy just go down the road of Liverpool and Klopp and their season, you know. So he's actually picked out three or four actual sort of you know, key incidents on in a particular game, and he's made them the focal point of the piece, and I think it works.
You know? Yeah, it leads to a really good piece. Yeah. If you turn back one page in the Mail on Sunday, you've got a buddy cop film on paper. You've got Danny Murphy and Steven Gerrard joining forces for this piece. I know lots of fans want me back as Liverpool boss one day, but the owners have to think I'm good enough first, says Steven Gerrard. What's your view on professional footballers sitting down for these sort of interviews? Do we get the best out of the subject?
I don't think so.
No, not remotely.
I always remember when Roy Keane was doing his book launch, one of his book launches in the Aviva Stadium, and Kevin Kilbane of This Parish was along, I think, possibly for Football Focus at the time.
Oh, it's got millions of views on YouTube at this point, I think.
And we were kind of, I say we, like myself and the other football journalists, you know the way these things are done, you know, they'll do TV, radio sort of set up, and the print journalists were kind of hanging on at the side, just waiting for our section or whatever. And I just remember Kilbane's face as he came out, you know, having gone through this sort of, you know, interview with Keane. And so, like, I'm not saying they were best mates, clearly, you know, but just that player v player sort of scenario of interview, that had value in it.
And did Kevin say anything when he came out of the room to you guys, or was it just stony silence?
No, I think there was just a look on his face, and we could all read it pretty quick, you know, in terms of what might have happened. But this interview in the Mail today, Danny Murphy and Gerrard, you know, they're two of them are sort of photographed. I don't know whose house they're in, maybe Gerrard's house. They're sort of sitting up at the breakfast bar in the kitchen and having their palsy-walsy chat. And it's just a little bit too palsy for me. There's nothing massively revealing in terms of Gerrard. Like, clearly wants to become the Liverpool manager, and a little bit of highlighted here, he's talking to Danny Murphy, and he says, "I'm bright enough to realise that you have to be good enough." This is in terms of taking over at Liverpool one day. "The owners need to think you're the right man. Let's say Klopp wins the Premier League, Champions League, and goes because he feels he can't do any more. They aren't going to pick me if I'm only the 20th best candidate." You know, so there's sort of a
self-awareness from Steven Gerrard?
Yeah.
Never thought I'd be saying that, to be honest.
But then towards the end of the interview, Danny Murphy asks him about forming, you know, coming to work in the Premier League one day and having this sort of managerial rivalry with Frank Lampard. And obviously, you know, there was so much made of them being not being able to play in the same team when they were playing. He says, so Gerrard says, "So would I. I'd like that to be part of that rivalry. I'm sure Frank has had the same thoughts, but I'd also love to become a rival to Jose Mourinho. Even now, I'm a rival to Neil Lennon and Derek McInnes. I hope I'm involved in this game a long time, but we know that a bad couple of years and I'll be sitting next to you on the match of the day couch."
that's pretty good. Like.
There's a couple of things here. The Gerard Houllier stuff, I'm not sure how much of this is new. Just Houllier's attention to detail. I know it's the oldest trope known to humankind that a French manager comes into a Premier League club and gets rid of the ketchup, as he mentions here. He says that he'd notice if you hadn't shaved and he'd stop you for chats and training and things like that. Kind of talks a little bit about Klopp. He says that he made his 2 years of mistakes away from the cameras, getting his pitch confidence. That's what he did at Liverpool with the youngsters. "I didn't go into Rangers thinking I'd cracked it," which is interesting. When you enter into a career like this, you have to almost portion off a section of your life where you have to say, that'll be failure. I have to fail at some point and I need to do it away from the limelight, which I think, even considering what Steven Gerrard has done, it is remarkable that he's in this position and with a fairly big club where we are following his every move. And he mentions Frank Lampard in this, and I think what Frank Lampard is doing is a step above that again. In his second gig, he's gone into Chelsea and he's like, with an acceptance that, "I will probably fail in certain aspects of this job. I just can't let it derail my profile or my reputation, or because that will actually derail my career." That football doesn't really have an acceptance for public failure, does it?
Mm. And particularly when there was a transfer ban in place at Chelsea as well. Like, you know, it's all the more commendable in terms of taking that role on when, you're right, like, if that didn't go right from, I know we've been at Derby, but if the Chelsea gig went bad for Lampard early on, how far back does that knock you, you know?
And, like, to be honest, like, he was in more of a sort of cushioned position, Lampard, though, in some respects, because that ban meant that, listen, I've got to do things a certain way. So, while at the same time, there was a case of, it's Chelsea, they've got a lot of money and all that, they can't spend it, so they're limited. So that he was able to succeed during that was almost the worst thing that could have happened to him, because now they've got money again. Because, like, he'd look like a good manager. Whereas with Gerrard, there was an attitude amongst Rangers fans of, well, we're rich again now, and now we've got a manager, let's go win stuff, and there's still no trophies. So he's still liked up there, but that's because he got a couple of wins over Celtic. But if he doesn't get any pieces of tin this season, then the pressure's going to really start coming in Glasgow, because in Rangers, it comes down to, have you got trophies and have you beaten Celtic to get those trophies? That's what it comes down to, essentially.
He talks about Rafa as well, saying that as a good manager, you have to be a good actor. You have to put a face on. And obviously we had Steven Gerrard celebrating big time against, wasn't it, Celtic earlier in the season. And he says, "I'll never apologise for being authentic. I am passionate after a win." I think he's right. I think that, you know, if Rafa is the man who's telling him to put on a mask to actually shield your emotions from the public, I think fair enough if it works for someone like Rafa Benitez. But if Steven Gerrard is the emotional type of manager, then go become a Klopp or a Pep or a Simeone. Exactly, yeah. Like, embrace that. There's no point changing what your initial character is. There are going to be fantastic quiet managers and fantastic noisy managers, and maybe Gerrard is going to be of the noisy type, the emotional type.
Yeah.
So I think it's something there. Perhaps he should ignore Rafa's advice. I think it's.
I did laugh at the ketchup line about the Julio one. It just reminded me of Trapattoni when he was Ireland manager and he banned the team from eating mushrooms because basically it gave him too much gas, and so he banned mushrooms from the Irish team camp.
Is that a scientific fact?
I don't know, actually.
I eat a lot of mushrooms. I don't think they have any effect on my gas. But anyway.
I remember Trapp telling us this. We were playing away to Montenegro, and he told us this in the pre-match press conference. It was the same day that he was sitting by one of these tables on a chair with wheels, and he was trying to sort of tell us, you know, emphasise the point or whatever. And he, whatever way, he just disappeared under the table. Like, the chair just went from underneath him. Anyway, sorry, random aside.
What else did Trapp ban? I wonder, did he come in thinking to himself, right, I'm Italian, these guys are Irish, I'm clearly going to be far more future thinking than all these schmucks over in the very west of Europe. And I wonder, did he just not find anything to change on a basic level and he just picked on mushrooms or something?
Yeah, he was fussy enough in terms of letting the players out as well, in terms of having a drink. And, you know, they certainly felt sort of very cooped up in Poland in the training camp that we had in Montecatini in Italy and things like that, you know. So, like, a bit of give and take on both sides. But yeah, the trap years were, there's a great book in the trap years somewhere down the line.
You know. Are you not working on it now, no?
I don't know if I'll be writing it, but yeah, no.
We're going to go back to the Sunday Independent, and it's more actually The Observer, just an article carried in the Sindo today. Haaland brings a cartoon freshness to a game in thrall to pixels and profit. This is Jonathan Wilson writing about Erling Haaland, who scored two goals against Paris Saint-Germain earlier this week. He is an unbelievable talent, and it's probably more than a talent at this point. He's already a superstar. I think, Emmett, you've seen this guy. You knew this guy before.
Been on the wrong end of it as a UCD fan. So got into the UCD, got into the UEFA Youth Champions League and played against Haaland and Midtjylland, and we just knew him as his father's son at that stage. Which, in fairness, most people until about a month and a half ago probably would have said the same. And it's like, you know, oh, this lad is very good at football and can score goals against us. But we wouldn't have been thinking, you know, playing for Dortmund within, like, I think it was like two years. Yeah, just over 2 years since he scored against UCD in the bowl, that he's like scoring two against Paris Saint-Germain. And honestly, it's the speed of the development, because even look at sort of his transfer moves, like, you know, sort of an 8 million a year ago, then suddenly a 20 million this year, and they're already talking that he's worth 60 million now, like within a month of that 20 million move.
But this guy's worth 200 million quid.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like, but, you know, I think it's more, it's not just that he's an exceptionally good footballer, it's that there's that rawness, and like Wilson mentions it here, like, you know, he's not, like, you know, entirely real at times. Like, he seemed like an adult, you know, is what he describes him as playing against the under-14s. He's 6'4", can kick the ball harder than anyone else, and able to not, you know, and so it's just, he's just that level. And that was the thing, you know, obviously we've all seen the goal get gift the mad run he had, like, you know, where he's outrunning Usain Bolt and stuff, although he had a running start. But it's just, it's the rate he's doing it. I even noticed, like, you know, football mates of mine and WhatsApp groups will just text Haaland the name, just, you know, as like a sort of an alarm, he has scored again, like, you know. And like, he's, I think he's on 11-7 appearances for Dortmund now, and it's like something like 10-7 in the Champions League. Like, he's just taking the mick at this point, you know. And he had a beautiful line though at the end, because he's not like this sort of, you know, particularly elegant player. Like, he is, a lot of it is guts and glory. He's just really, really good at the guts and glory. He's a reminder that football is still about the joy of wellying a ball to score the winning goal.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful line, I think, in it.
Because it ties in nicely. His first sentence is, it can be difficult to remember why we ever started liking football. And I think Haaland is a great reminder of this. A couple of interesting things that stuck out to me is that I didn't realise that his growth spurt happened so late in his life.
That was news to me as well.
Coaches a small striker,
yeah,
which is perhaps a bit of an alarm bell for any coaches who want to get good at developing youngsters, is actually coached him technically rather than actually utilising the big guy for being a big guy solely. Yeah. Because this guy was never going to be the size that he was according to his coaches. He was always going to be too small to make it.
Yeah, it's at 15 there, you were concerned he'd still be too small to make it as a footballer, which is crazy. That's 4 years ago. Like, you know, like, yeah, 2 years ago, he was still a big lad. Trust me, he was in Belfield. Like,
there's a line here at the end that says, perhaps Haaland too will be tainted in time. The culture of football tends to be toxic, and his agent is Mino Raiola. He goes, but for now, his worst trait appears to be his grumpiness with the media. Even that, in a world of image management and knowing celebrity, is refreshing.
What do you do if you're Erling Haaland at this point? Like, bearing in mind that Mino Raiola will be stirring the pot nicely here, Do you hang around? Do you become a legend of the yellow wall for another season or two?
Honestly, being cynical, you let Mino Raiola tell you what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And you just keep scoring goals no matter what the jersey is. So,
for all the negative press for Raiola, like, I think his clients seem to be reasonably okay with everything, don't they?
Well, the proof will be in the pudding, and the pudding is Jesse Lingard's next move.
Well,
in
yeah, that was quite the move to, you know, quite the move to Raiola. But I presume, I don't know the ins and outs of Manchester United's transfer policy and the inner workings of the club or anything like that, but I presume the Raiola factor in terms of United trying to get him, you know, they were heavily linked with him. I presume the whole Pogba situation at United.
The thing is, now everybody will want to get him. Like, you know, Real will spend whatever it takes. Barca, yeah, will spend whatever it takes. There isn't a football club that will not spend. Like you're saying, like, he's reaching the 200 million level of, because he's 19, he's scoring like this. Like, the only guy who got this level of attention at his age was Mbappe, realistically, in recent years. Yeah, well, I mean, sort of more in terms of, like, in recent years when it comes to the current level of transfer money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, so it's like, where you're talking about that, it's like, right, okay, he's an instant impact at that age.
But also being ready.
Yes, and being ready, he's an instant impact. Like,
it's like you can watch Haaland now and say, this is not a prospect. This guy right now is absolutely world class. And the same with Mbappe, when I guess it did take to the World Cup for him to actually get to that level. But Haaland, it seems to be at that level right now. And it's quite a sight to see.
Yeah, and you look at that, and I know it's not a like-for-like comparison at all, but you're looking at a 19-year-old player who's just burst onto the world scene. And then we localise it to our own issues with an 18-year-old in Troy Parrott and only just a recently turned 18-year-old, you know. And you can see what youth can do when given their chance.
Oh, yeah.
I just wonder if Haaland was at Tottenham, would he be playing as much? Would Jose be playing? He couldn't not play him, you know. He's proven at that level.
Good question. And what we can basically take from that is that Troy Parrott is Erling Braut Haaland, and we're just not seeing him at the moment.
Yeah, and it's going to be beautiful when we see it.
Like, absolutely. You know. Right. So we've got three hurling stories today. We're going to do two of them. I picked the black card. You picked Shane Conway, Emmett, and you picked Shane O'Brien, Paul. We have vetoed the black card, you'll be happy to hear, ladies and gentlemen. We are not talking about annual Congress. We are not talking about that. Michael Deignan and Micheál Clifford in the Irish Daily Mail writing about it today, or in the Irish Mail on Sunday, I should say, for anybody who wants to check that out. Will you start with Shane Conway, Emmett?
Yeah, it's in the Sunday Times. I haven't got it in front of me here, but it's like beautiful piece about a player from a part of the world where we don't normally talk about hurling too much, and that's the thing that jumps out with it. Conway, it's from his time with UCC that he's sort of been able to get the attention. It's Dennis Walsh did it, because he's with the Fitzgibbon run UCC had to, this year. You know, he's been likened, as we have here, to Lionel Messi of hurling, which is not exactly, you know, the worst in terms of, you know, comparisons. But, like, you got Tom Kingston basically saying that, you know, none of the Limerick starting full forward line have the same level of skill as this guy from Lixnaw and Kerry. Mm. And I think that's the thing that jumps out. But there's also a few bits here about, so we all talk about the whole sort of over-reverence towards hurling and all that, over-reverence even, sorry, towards hurling, but sometimes you do like to see that little, that enjoy a sport, and that 14-year-old Conway was annoyed he couldn't play senior hurling yet because the rules said he couldn't. And that's like that tiny little level of, because, like, you know, North Kerry hurling is, you know, about as physical as typical Junior B hurling is everywhere else, just a lot higher quality player, but it's pretty violent. And this 14-year-old is like, who's slight and all that, wants to go in and just get his head knocked off him because he just wants to keep playing as much hurling as possible. It's an unusual one, though, because we don't talk about Kerry hurlers that often for a reason. Like, it's not a noted county forward. So when you got a guy with this level of talent, like, it sort of reminds you almost of Matty Ford at Wexford, where, you know, is sort of the talent going to be given enough room to shine? Can they go that far? And obviously Wexford had that one run to an All-Ireland semi-final, but that was it. That's all they actually, if you look at the Matty Ford era, they have one particular golden moment. Mm. With Kerry, like, they can they can probably get up, you know, at some point realistically to the Leinster Championship, you know. Well, they've been there before.
Well,
like,
I think,
you know,
the way the rules are at the moment is it has to be the Munster Championship, which is
they go back into Leinster, don't they, I think, at this stage? It's very confusing, despite being a Munster county. You know,
I think they actually changed it a couple of years ago, where they have to beat the person who finished the bottom of Munster, whereas the way it used to be, obviously, as you say, it was Leinster Championship. So if they reverted it to that, perhaps.
But, like, you know, it's like the ceiling is very hard, and it says a lot about sort of, you know, team players. But for him, because with UCC, even with these restricted versions we now have, the Fitzgibbon and Sigerson, because they're all rushed off, it's probably the most he's ever going to be in the spotlight as a hurler at a national level. And it's unfortunate seeing that, but it's been great to see Dennis Walsh, like, just get into the story of a young guy who's still 19 and playing it because he just really wants to play for Kerry and hurling. There's no talk of, you know, moving to Limerick and conveniently finding a relative that means it's okay, or naturalising, whatever. Like, it's like he wants to wear a Kerry jersey in hurling, and that's kind of refreshing, because my first thought was, you know, even when I started reading this morning, was, so what county is he going to find a way to play for? Automatically, as I was reading, and it goes, oh, he's definitely not doing that. Like, so really upbeat, happy stuff.
Or how does he find a way to make his way into the football team? And he's got absolutely no interest.
He had a run out with the football, and he goes, ah, yeah, it's not for me.
Yeah. Which is interesting, because two of his neighbours would be Paul Galvin and Eamon Fitzmaurice, who, Galvin in particular, would have been an excellent, excellent hurler.
Galvin would tell you he's from hurling country, really. Like, he's a footballer who happens to be from hurling country. Like, because it is a small part of Kerry, but it is a purely hurling part of Kerry, like.
Yeah, exactly. So it's funny that he's managed to actually shake that off, because you do have to have a fairly strong personality to be able to say, no, I'm not going to play football, and not going to take all the fanfare that comes with that. Just one other thing at the end of that piece, which I found interesting, was that he said no to the gym, basically, for his entire career so far. Granted, he's still a young man, but just wouldn't do it. Just says, I'm fine the way I am, 5'9", 11 stone.
That's exactly what it is, 5'9", 11 stone. So, like, he's not like a big dude at all, like, you know.
But he's relented now. He's gone into the gym. So we're going to see a bigger, bulkier, better Shane Conway.
I'm sorry, I haven't actually read this piece. So he's stayed away from the gym.
Yeah.
I would say to a point. Now, I would say he hasn't been lifting weights. Maybe he's been doing his, I don't know, maybe he's been doing fitness work in the winter. But
there's always an argument, though, that for a lot of guys, it's like the weights, the later you take them up, like sort of as a teenager, the better. Like, because I remember like talking to Aidan Igahan, like the basketball player, about 2 years ago, and he didn't start until he was at the very last year of high school. Like, so, like, leaving cert year, basically, him was when he started doing weights. Everything else was purely sort of, you know, it's a more standard, like, sort of, you know, restrictive stuff. But it was like very much he avoided the weights until as old as he could, because he found it was better to keep the fluidity in his body and his movement. So,
is it too dissimilar to what we were just talking about in Jonathan Wilson's piece about Haaland being coached technically as a youngster because he was never going to be the physical specimen, and then lo and behold, the physicality comes later on in his teens? Yeah. That perhaps people are just being started on these programs way too soon.
Yeah, you can get it wrong as well. Like, over the years, I'd have seen, now they're sort of, they're rare enough, but you would have seen a few League of Ireland players who clearly were doing too much in the gym.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
Some of them looked like they'd get a game in the Leinster back row rather than sort of being able to get around a football, you know, run around a football pitch, and they're just clearly far too big.
And were these young lads or?
Yeah, young enough.
You notice when it's like not natural. Like, you know, there's some guys who are, I say natural, I mean naturally suited to doing gym work. You know, as in, so like, we've had a couple of lads go through UCDs over the years, like, you know, who were like Maxi Cagoon's the best known, who was perfectly suited to doing that, and it didn't have any impact at all on the way he played the game of football.
Yeah.
Whereas you see the other lad who go through, you know, over the years, a few footballers, and it's just they shouldn't be trying to get that bulky, that force. Like, they should let it come to them a little bit. Like, you know, work with the weights intelligently, I suppose.
Yeah, I remember interviewing Greg Bulger, Shamrock Rovers midfielders. And Greg is sort of snapping, snarling, win the ball back, lay it off kind of player, a bit of all action sort of midfielder, you know. And he was telling us that he's won leagues at other clubs, you know, he's won a league of Pats, he's been successful, but he always... Last season we interviewed him at Rovers, and he said that he felt that he's actually been doing too much gym work over the course of his career, and that it was actually slowing him down because he was just getting a bit too bulky. Mm. Now, he's not one of the players I had in my mind when I was thinking about it. It's not quite the same sort of analogy, but he made a point last season at Rovers of laying off the weights and being put onto a program completely the opposite of half his teammates. Mm. Because he just found the more he bulked up, the slower he became in terms of trying to get around that midfield, you know.
Right, okay.
So he's gone completely the opposite, and he's lost weight, and he's got much quicker for it as well.
But his teammates are putting on weight.
Yeah, well, I presume they are, or not necessarily, you know yourself, it's not like rugby where you have to be a beast to play. Ideally, you shouldn't be, you know, you should be fairly lithe and get around the pitch. But Greg just felt that he was just a bit too stocky maybe for the type of game he plays, and having to cover ground on a pitch and to close down players and put tackles in. So he went the other way, and the Rovers physios and the Rovers sort of medical team worked with him and came up with the plan of less is more. Mm. And he's gone completely the other way, and he's lost weight, and he's trimmer, and he's quicker, and it's helped his game as well.
I guess it helps different parts of the season as well. Like, I noticed certainly the opening day of the league, the Dubs, for example, looked very big, looked much bigger than did at any point last year. So that's obviously just their pre-season conditioning, and then they slim down as they get towards the harder ground and all that.
That's sort of classic, sort of in the gym over Christmas, you know, like League of Ireland teams as well now. You know, it used to be a case that they'd come back to pre-season in January or whatever, but they're all on these fitness programs over Christmas. The Dundalk team now, I think some of the teams have the same thing. They're all working off an app that they have where the strength and conditioning coaches. I remember talking to some of the Dundalk players at one of the black tie functions over Christmas, and they were just saying, like, no, like, you know, it's a week before Christmas, but, you know, we're training on Christmas Eve, we're doing this, we're doing that.
It's a different mentality, even just about 10, 15 years ago. I remember Michael O'Donnell was a UCD long-time sort of, you know, okay footballer. His entire career, essentially, in the League of Ireland is down to having been smarter about fitness than anyone else, because he'd always have more stamina than the second half of the season. So you'd see him when a lot of guys, he'd be, you know, on the bench, not really getting the look in first half of the season. This was the entire career this man had. And then suddenly second half of the season, like, well, Mick's in great shape. We should put him in up front, like, you know. And, like, and this is, again, you know, UCD, which would be one of the smarter ones when it came to fitness. Even he was just on other level. But, like, nowadays, like, that's not an advantage, because, like, you've got all this built in. So do actual thinking about sort of, you know, your carbs and, you know, the food you eat, all deadly seriously. Whereas, you know, back then the Derek Swan spice bag approach wasn't quite as, you know, as forgiven.
Right, we've got time for one last story. We're going to go to Shane O'Brien, Paul. It's in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah, it's a Dermot Crowe piece in the Sunday Independent, and a fairly sizable full page piece as well. So Shane O'Brien, I have to admit, I didn't know anything about Shane O'Brien. I didn't know who he was until I read this piece. So Shane O'Brien is the Westmeath hurling manager, and they're in Division 1 of the National Hurling League this season. And I think they've lost their three games so far, and they're off to play Tipperary this afternoon. So, you know, life gets easier. But the piece, sort of Dermot in his piece kind of tees it up quite early on. He says, Shane O'Brien's biggest fear for much of this conversation isn't the prospect of playing the All-Ireland champions in Thurles today. It's that this might project him in a light that he'll be uncomfortable with. So he's clearly not somebody who wants kind of a great deal of attention. He's quietly sort of going around his background. He admits himself in the piece that, you know, he doesn't have much of a playing background himself. I think he played maybe Dublin Minor, Dublin Under 21 level. He played for Coolham when they weren't a particularly fashionable team. He had a few coaching stints then around the place. Ellert the Balla, Dublin Senior Camogie team, Trinity College and the Kildare team as well. So he's assembled, he talks about it in the piece here and goes through the names, but he's assembled a good backroom team. But he very clearly was never too happy with the limelight, and he kind of talks about it. He feels it sort of stems from when he was a player himself. He says, one of the things in many ways that nearly restricted me as a player was that it nearly meant too much to me, and I was overthinking, obsessive about my passion of the game. I overanalyzed things as a player. I was quite nervous playing, and I find it didn't make the progress I should have. I was no big shot. I was a mediocre hurling. It was the whole fear of making mistakes, the fear of being criticised, that restricted me. I'd like to think that I would have an understanding of that side of things as a manager. And the piece goes on, and, you know, so that immediately kind of, I found that, you know, that was a good hook, you know, just in terms of big full page interview on a guy who just doesn't like the limelight. So immediately I'm kind of interested in that, because as a journalist, you always want to interview the big names. You know, everyone wants to interview the big names. But when the big names are being wheeled out so often, and they're usually commercial gigs and stuff, you don't generally get that much out of them anymore. I know from covering the Irish football team, it's very hard to get anything out of a player in 10, 15 minutes when there's 12 of you sitting at a table talking to them. So sometimes the best stories are these ones that are sort of under the radar. But in the piece, Dermot Crowe, he's talking to Shane O'Brien, and he's talking about taking on the Westmead Challenge at a time when his one-year-old daughter had been diagnosed with cancer. And he does say in the piece that she's doing great now, and thank God she had to get a tumour removed. And so he was saying that he was very unsure at the time about taken on this role when he obviously had such a difficult sort of time of things going on with his family. But he sort of says here, there's a quote from O'Brien here, it says, it also highlights the importance of sport and having that support and connection with something to have. It's a tiny distraction at the time, you know. But then you keep on reading, and there's more good stuff in it as well, because he's talking about sort of society, social media, and the potential, you know, the damage that social media can do. And again, all under the caveat of this guy doesn't seem to like the attention, you know. So if you just read a small bit of this, he says, society has become so concerned with being politically correct, and we tend to get offended quite easily, yet we tolerate and accept abuse and nasty comments on social media that are directed towards others, and especially amateur sports people. These people are spineless individuals who get a rush of power while hiding behind computer screens. It would make you wonder how someone can give a kick, can get a kick out of this behaviour. Perhaps it gives them a sense of self-importance or validation. It's also sad how much weight some people place on likes and retweets. And what example is this setting when a grown adult craves likes on social media? Mm. And it sort of finishes off then on a much sort of lighter note, in terms of a chance meeting that he had with Brendan Rodgers when he was Celtic manager here in Ireland. And his son, Shane O'Brien's son, had also met Rodgers, but cut a long story short, they were invited over to behind the scenes at Celtic. Yeah. Yeah. And it was 2 days after an Old Firm derby where Celtic had won the game. And O'Brien is in one of the meeting rooms with Rodgers, just having a chat, and the stats guy comes in with sort of video of the Celtic win over Rangers, and he starts playing it on the screen, and Rodgers is sitting there chatting to Shane O'Brien, asking him what does he think of this and what does he think of that, you know.
He doesn't say what he said in return to that question.
No, he doesn't. No, but it's just a really good piece. And again, I didn't know who Shane O'Brien was, but I thought it was a really good read.
Yeah, it's excellent, and I think there's so many different elements of it. Like the social media stuff is very interesting. I think his point about the kind of conflict between people being offended / politically correctness and all that sort of stuff, and the tolerance for abuse and nasty comments, is actually a good point. I haven't heard too many people actually make that point. But then also just this kind of theory that people have of great players not making great managers and all that, that he's put it down there in fairly clear terms, that because he wasn't as good as some of his peers at hurling, he has more empathy for the less good players now when he's a manager. And
yeah,
perhaps that's perfect when you're in a situation in Division 1 as Westmeath boss, that you will be coming up against very, very strong teams, teams that are better than you and have bigger resources than you and all that sort of thing. That it's a little bit different, that it's fine if you're the unbelievably talented player who becomes a manager and has a great batch of players to work with, because you can instill higher standards. But conversely, if you drew a great hurler into the Westmeath team, perhaps there might be an element of frustration with them as manager. So yeah, it's a great piece. It's worth checking out in today's Sunday Independent. I did promise you at the top of the Sunday paper review today, though, because all the back pages are covered really by three letters only, VAR. Emmett is going to quickly, in about 60 seconds or less,
I just have to go with the Sun, purely because this is like Christmas for the Sun, because they've loved the Sun on Sunday, obviously, because they've loved the VAR thing. Obviously, we have the Bridge to VAR on the back page, but we've got, you know, laughing stock Lee Park, you know, we got the bit from the referee expert in as well. They've just got everything possible, even showing where Jose was looking when Lo Celso hit Azpilicueta. How did Jose not see it? They've just basically gone full CSI in this. And honestly, if you get a chance to look at today's Sun, just do it for that. Like, you know, the inside back page, like, you know, it's like it was clear and obvious VAR has had his worst day yet. I'm sure a lot of people will say, was it really the worst day for VAR, because there's been so many of them? But yeah, no, just purely for how much the Sun clearly enjoyed covering this, it's worth having a look at, because everybody in the sports sections went big on VAR. The Sun, it was like the happiest thing that's ever happened to them, and I'm happy for them.
Great stuff. I like that. One last point on that?
Just a totally different one. A decent read with Leighton Aspel, jockey raised in County Clare. He's retiring ahead of Cheltenham. He had back-to-back Grand National winners in 2014, 2015, Ainshie Grand National winners. But he's retiring ahead of Cheltenham, and it seems to have dawned on him, because he says, I'm going to die a Cheltenham Festival virgin.
Right, that's worth checking out. That's the Sunday Mail, is it?
Yeah, it's in the Irish Mail on Sunday. It's not a huge piece, but a short piece with Leighton Aspel, just about to retire from the saddle.
Very good. Paul O'Hare, Emmett Ryan, thanks a million for popping in. That is us for this week's Sunday Papers. As ever, back next week on youtube.com/offtheball.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.